Welcome to Neil and Matt versus the Paranormal, a podcast in which two people of questionable talent and dubious virtue discuss a tale from paranormal history. Follow us on iTunes and Stitcher, and if you're so inclined, leave us a review. But in any case, on with the show. Good day, and welcome to the third episode of Neil and Matt versus the Paranormal, a podcast in which I, Neil, relate a story from paranormal history to a person who may or may not be called Matt, but who on this happy occasion is indeed called Matt.
And I can give positive feedback and inane comments.
Much better than the feedback we just had from the microphone setup. So yeah, hopefully this will actually be audible to our listeners, such of the two or three people that it may be. Okay, fantastic. Without any further ado, let's go straight into it, into our tale from paranormal history, and something of a change of pace from our last two episodes featuring ghost investigator Harry Price. On the 29th of April 1953 in Butterworth, South Africa, William Ernest Drummond was born. I love it when you take notes.
It's very attentive. Short memory. You know, nobody knew that until you ruined it. Until
exposed your cognitive shortcomings.
William. Is that two L's?
It is.
Okay, William.
And I've written Drummond with three M's, but it is just two. His father was a minister for the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. And 18 months later, the family moved back to their homeland, settling in the southwest town, Newton Stewart. Drummond and family moved to Corby, Northamptonshire, in 1964. As Drummond prepared to leave school at 17, and unsure of where to go next, he consulted the careers advice officer. The careers advice officer recommended Drummond undertake an apprenticeship at the local steelworks, but Drummond turned this down. His mother paid for him to attend a professional careers advisor, not these amateurs that you get in schools, of course. And apologies to any careers advisors out there. Thank you for your service.
What are the chances of the two listeners that we have? What are the chances that one of them is a careers advisor?
So his mother paid for him to attend a professional careers advisor who recommended he become a musical instrument maker. This would entail...
I thought you were going to say recommended he become a musical instrument. A banjo or piano.
This would entail Drummond attending a furniture maker's college, but before that he would have to go to arts college, which he agreed with. He pursued arts college and ended up at the Liverpool Art and Design Academy. Whilst he loved art, he came to believe that he was not a great artist and left in 1973. In 1976, after several odd jobs, Drummond was working as a carpenter and stage painter for the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool, where he was employed by experimental theatre director and later director of The Warp, the longest play in the world, Ken Russell, to design sets for his stage production of Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea's Illuminatus trilogy. So a few extra biographical notes. The Warp is a 22-hour long play, or cycle of plays.
Which must be about the same length as these podcasts feel to anyone that has to listen to them.
But mildly less entertaining.
Yeah, it's like that's what this is, or The Warp is less entertaining?
I think The Warp's almost certainly more entertaining than these podcasts. Okay. The Illuminatus trilogy. So, have you heard of it?
No.
Exposing your ignorance once again.
Again, I think anyone that listens to this knows that I'm pretty high up on the ignorance level.
No, you're the straight man, it's fine. You're not meant to know any of these things. So, the Illuminatus trilogy we'll almost certainly discuss in more detail in future episodes. It's something that will come up, no doubt, time and time again. Any attempt to summarise it concisely is likely doomed to failure. But as an attempt, it's a postmodern science fiction mystery which presents a kind of unified conspiracy theory, a sort of theory of everything filtered through a worldview inspired by the real or possibly not real religion slash philosophy of Discordianism. Like Discordianism, the Illuminatus trilogy is concerned with the Greek goddess Eris, the goddess of chaos. It's been described as the literary version of an acid trip.
Right, so is it one of Dan Brown's creations? Is that...
Bizarrely, Dan Brown probably took a little bit of the conspiracy stuff from it, but none of the interesting elements or literary talent at all. Sorry, Dan.
Okay.
Yeah. Not if he's listening. It's very, very odd. I've tried to read it three or four times, and to nail my colours to the mast, I generally get to about page 70 and think, not now, I'll do it later.
Okay.
But yes, all of the conspiracy, it was absolutely laden with conspiracy stuff, the Illuminati, the Knights Templars, UFOs, all sorts of stuff like that. So any of your conspiracy media from... Go on.
Okay, so nailing your colours to the mast type thing. Conspiracy theories just bug me.
But why?
Because most of them are bollocks. Can we say bollocks?
Yes, yeah.
Good. Because if you're going to take a conspiracy theory, you're just going to go mad, aren't you? Because I think I'm being bugged.
Do you think you're being bugged?
Yeah, I feel like someone's recording everything that I'm saying. Okay, bad example right now, but I mean, you know, anytime you can start convincing yourself that somebody's watching you, or you just become paranoid if everything is a conspiracy. And also, having worked for a number of government agencies, none of which we can name.
Goodness me, this is exciting.
It is exciting.
It's a conspiracy theory of our own.
I know they are all incompetent. Most, I believe in cock-up, not conspiracy. That's all I'm saying. I think things go wrong more often than people manufacture a story around something going wrong. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we discussed it before, Hanlon's razor.
Yes.
Which is never to attribute to sort of sinister intent, something that can be better described through incompetence.
Yes. And I am incompetent.
And sinister.
And sinister, yeah, that's true.
Therefore, straddling both lines of the razor. That sounds painful.
Oh.
So, yes, I attempted to come up with a better, concise description of it, but having not actually read it, it was quite difficult.
Why don't you just do what we do and just look on the back of the book?
The blurb.
The blurb.
Well, it's actually three books. It is a trilogy, but I have the collected edition.
Go on to Amazon and see what ratings it gets, where you get a 1-star because this book turned up late.
Yes, that's so frustrating. Really, yeah, or there was something wrong with the cover. Or,
yeah.
Misleading. But my attempt to summarise it was, it's a little bit like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy crossed with The Da Vinci Code. It's a good call with the Dan Brown.
I know stuff.
But written by someone with a very tenuous grasp on what is real and what is not real. And I mentioned earlier the Discordianism, the religion / philosophy / practical joke that inspired a lot of the stuff in it. And together they sort of intermingle and share a lot of back and forth. But we'll absolutely get to those later on as well. So I'm seeding the future episodes into this one.
Very good. Can we mention Scientology as well? Because in terms of getting paranoid and people watching you and recording you, let's say something negative about Scientology and then they can start stalking us.
Gang stalk us and then drive us slowly mad. Not that Scientology do that, of course.
Absolutely
it's merely a supposition for comedic reasons.
Absolutely not. Otherwise, my name isn't Stephen.
Sorry, Tom. And if you need to get out, just wink twice in your next interview. So Ken Campbell, director of the longest play in the world, adapted the Illuminatus trilogy as a cycle of 5 plays that would last over 8 hours in performance. So nothing compared to the 22 hours of The Warp, of course.
We said it was Ken Russell.
Did I say Ken Clark?
No, you said Ken Campbell just then. You meant Ken Russell, didn't you?
Did.
You did.
Drummond's stage designs were extremely well received, reflecting the chaotic nature of the work by manipulating perspective to produce disorientating effects. The cycle of plays was also well received and the production transferred to the National Theatre in London. So they've gone from Liverpool to London. Drummond completed the sets for the premiere in London, but then announced he was going out to get some glue and never came back.
Wow.
Cheeky.
That's a lot of glue.
It depends what he did with the glue.
Have you got stuck? Thank you. That's my fee earned right there, isn't it?
I'm not going to thank you for that.
We haven't discussed my fee yet, have we?
No, there is a reason for that.
Is there?
We've discussed enough non-existent things on this podcast.
Fair enough, okay. Thanks.
So, one of the people that attended the Illuminatus premiere, however, although Bill Drummond did not, was Jimmy Courty, a young artist from Cheshire who had drawn popular fantasy art for posters and cover art related to The Lord of the Rings and Lord Dunsany's The King of Elfland's Daughter. So some real deep dive geeky stuff there.
Weird people, I was going to say, but yeah.
Well, that's very judgmental.
It is very judgmental, but hey.
Enjoying this?
Immensely.
So Drummond returned to Liverpool, purchased a guitar and formed the punk band Big in Japan with his friend Clive Langer, Kevin Ward and Phil Allen, whose music you can hear at this very moment.
Oh, that's the link.
Yes, this wasn't just a random musical sting.
See, clever.
It was. So later members included Jane Casey, Ian Browdy and Holly Johnson. Although emerging at the same time as punk and nominally being a punk band, their eccentric performances set them apart, with Jane Casey singing whilst wearing a lampshade over her shaved head and Drummond playing in a kilt. One thing that did unite them with punk was the prominence of performance over proficiency, with their relative musical skill being secondary to the performance. Their artsiness might explain their negative reception at the time, however, which included a petition launched by Julian Cope, later of The Teardrop Explodes, calling on the band to split. The members of the band themselves signed the petition. The band split up in 1978.
Say that again. They signed a petition for their own disbandment.
Yes.
Okay, so who said we are separating due to musical similarities?
Oh, I don't know. Who did say that?
Beautiful South.
The Beautiful South.
Beautiful South split up saying that they had irreconcilable musical similarities or something like that.
Is that a tacit admission that they're a bit shit?
No, that they were just bored of each other. It's been going on for too long.
Mm-hmm. Name a Beautiful South ideas. Song?
36D.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah.
Oh, that anyway. Nice. Oh, I was going to say that nice, but it's the end of that song. It's still some more to come. No, this is the same.
The other thing you said there was that they were better. Something about content rather than quality or something.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, that reminds me of somebody. I just can't think who that is. What other...
Look, a lot of research went into this. It's just delivered badly.
Oh, blame me.
It's an entirely different problem.
Oh, okay.
The performance is worse than the proficiency.
And the other funny thing is, Big in Japan is one of my favourite songs.
By...
Yes.
Sorry?
By them.
By who?
I can't remember.
You're lying.
I'm not going to try and sing it. Big in Japan. Tonight, Big in Japan. Hold tight. Doobie doobie. Big in Japan.
So, he's formed a punk band, or post-punk possibly, and they wear lampshades and kilts and all that sort of stuff, and they signed their own petition to...
Disband. So are you saying there's something wrong with wearing kilts and playing musical instruments?
Absolutely not. No, I think it's a fine tradition that they upheld in a very unique way.
Yes. So backtracking quickly there before you have every Scotsman and a woman trying to kill you. But anyway.
The band split up in 1978, having only recorded 7 songs.
Shame.
Drummond started Zoo Records with his fellow band member David Ralph, releasing music from the now defunct Big in Japan and other bands from the Liverpool post-punk scene, including Echo and the Bunnymen and the Teardrop Explodes. Wow. Both of which I presume you've heard of?
I've heard of, yeah.
Absolutely. Drummond went on to manage both bands in some capacity, although as might be expected, he managed them in a rather idiosyncratic fashion. He was exhibiting magical thinking, seeing correspondences and connecting them to an internal symbology that he invested with meaning. So, magical thinking, you're happy with that concept?
Thinking, happy with, magical, happy with, both together. So he thinks stuff's magic.
So I would say magical thinking is any sort of thinking where you connect external things with internal change and vice versa. So, if you were to define magic, not in terms of Lord Paul of the Rings Daniels. And fantasy, okay. And Paul Daniels. Well, indeed, or Paul Daniels. You looked to sort of magical figures from the 20th century. One school of thought would be that it is affecting change through the exertion of your will, through your will alone. So your internal will having an external effect.
Right.
There's probably quite a few stages you could look at that as being connected to. So let's say, for example, you're an athlete of some description and it's your lucky ritual to toss a coin before a match, something like that. That's magical thinking. You're linking the ritual that you're conducting to affect change.
Isn't that NLP as well? Isn't that kind of...
Yeah, very similar. There's magical thinking elements in that.
Okay, so it's positive reinforcement. I can live with that. Okay. Well, I'm not sure that's magical, but...
Well, there's different ways of looking at it, because you could look at it on the first level, which is just you do it and you expect an effect to come from it, and you don't really necessarily delve any deeper than that.
Yep.
You look at the next stage, which is you do it, you know that there's no real effect to it, but it's like a psychological crutch for you. It's a little confidence.
Yeah, that's, I think what NLP is. Yeah.
That's another level.
Yeah.
A deeper level would be you genuinely believe there is a connection between you flicking the coin and then the effect of winning the match or whatever it is. So you believe there is some sort of actual connection between those two events. So if you did not flip the coin, there would be no winning of the match.
So when you say a deeper level, you mean bollocks?
Well, possibly a crazier level.
Yeah.
And then I suppose you get to the deepest level, which is where you see lots of external things around you and make connections with other things happening with no real evidence.
Also known as paranoia.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Someone with
great
paranoia would assume, really, that everything around them in the world somehow relates to their own experience. So I was speaking to someone once who was clearly going through a crisis of some description.
Was it me?
No,
not
surprisingly
me.
Okay. Not. Okay. And was talking about how they were walking down the street and they saw someone motioning out. They described it as like a teapot motion. So motioning out their arm outstretched, the other arm up slightly. And they said that because they did that, they knew that person was communicating to them that they were going to follow them.
Right.
So the two different things.
Yeah.
Her walking down the street, the person gesturing their arm, completely unrelated, completely unconnected. But she saw that as something deeply connected to her.
And do you think? And she genuinely believed that?
Genuinely believed it. Okay. Genuinely believed
it. Okay, so that's not the sort of stuff that I believe, but I understand there are some people in this world, for whatever flawed reason, don't view things the same as me. Okay, I can live with that. And that's magical thinking in this context, yeah.
Yeah, I would say any sort of drawing connection between symbols, real or imagined, and your actual conduct and effect on the world. Really mixing up of the internal and the external, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is quite deep.
It is. Yeah, okay. But I would say the level at which we're sort of pitching at here when we talk about magical thinking is people that perhaps understand that there's not any tangible physical relationship between two events. Mm-hmm. So going back to the sporting metaphor, someone that tosses the coin, goes through that little ritual to win the match. Now, they're not doing it just for the psychological burst that we discussed, not just for that little reinforcement. They're also not doing it because they genuinely believe deep down that event A will have a definite measurable effect on event B.
Yeah.
But they're somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
So it's not just psychological. It's not a clear, tangible, physical connection, but they believe some sort of link, which would be probably very difficult for anyone to define, between event A and event B. And the ritual is their sort of conduit between those two things.
Okay.
Okay, happy with that?
Yeah.
Excellent. One example for old Bill was his reaction to the cover of the Bunnyman's first single, Pictures on My Wall. This featured the scrawled graffiti-like image of a rabbit-like figure. In Drummond's mind, this rabbit was Echo, and he developed this into a symbolic figure, a sort of trickster god inspired by Scandinavian folklore. So he's seen this, he's developed his own internal sort of connection of symbols around it.
Yeah, I'm trying to work out if he's a genius or a lunatic.
The band had always claimed that the name Echo and the Bunnymen had been chosen randomly and had no inherent meaning. Nonetheless, Drummond began to see the figure in other images connected to the band and began to manage them according to this internal symbology. He arranged their tour dates according to locations he felt were connected by meaning and arranged for the band to cycle around Liverpool across a route that would trace the symbol of Echo's rabbit ears if seen from above.
Did anybody see it from above?
No.
Okay.
But he knew.
Okay.
In 1983, he decided to attempt a magical ritual by having the Bunnymen play in Iceland whilst the Teardrop Explodes played in Papua New Guinea so he could access a mystical form of energy that flowed between the two locations and passed under a manhole cover in Liverpool.
Do you know how many manhole covers there are in Liverpool?
Oh no, he's specifically selected a manhole cover. He's got three locations. His particular area in Liverpool, Papua New Guinea, Iceland. He's arranged his two proxies to be there. And he will stand on the manhole cover in Liverpool and access the mystical energy that will emerge the moment those two bands play at the same time.
Nothing happened, did it?
Well, it didn't quite go to plan. Mm-hmm. Because when he attempted it, indeed, nothing happened.
He got run over by a bus that was driving over this
manhole cover. No, he was perfectly fine, I'm pleased to say.
Good for you. By the way, is this guy dead before I keep slandering him?
Okay. No, good.
Okay, great.
Well, I mean, it's good he's not dead. It's perhaps not good you keep slandering him.
No, probably not. Okay.
So, when he attempted it, nothing happened, quite right. But it could be because the Teardrop Explodes wouldn't play, according to his plan, and didn't play in Papua New Guinea at the same time. So then he had the Bunnymen in Iceland, alas.
Yeah, so it certainly might work.
Might work, we'll never know.
Okay.
He continued to work in the music industry and released a gentle album of folk music called The Man in 1986. The following year, he decided to form a new band, and he contacted Jimmy Courtney, our chap from the King of Elfland's Daughter and Lord of the Rings fantasy art creation. Yep. Who he had met through music industry connections 2 years prior. So after Jimmy had been to the concert, premiere of the Illuminatus trilogy plays. Drummond decided to call the band the Justified Ancients of Mumu. After the ancient Babylonian sect that worshipped chaos in the Illuminatus trilogy.
Yes.
Courtney responded to this, having long ago attended the premiere as we discussed, and this affirmed their collaboration. Sound familiar?
It does sound familiar. It takes me back to my childhood.
It was 1987. Hip-hop was big. Hence the hip-hop with Scottish brogue that we just heard.
Scottish hip-hop.
Scott Hop.
Scott, yeah.
Courtney and Drummy originally performed under pseudonyms Rockman Rock and King Boy D. It was clear sampling was going to be a prominent part of their approach, although this would also get them in trouble. So a bit like that Beatles sample.
Yeah, just exactly. Heard. We're not supposed to do that sort of thing.
Not really. I mean, it's more acceptable now to sample, of course.
Yeah, of course it is.
Their debut album, 1987, What the Fuck Is Going On, hit legal trouble when lawyers representing ABBA demanded the album be withdrawn, as one of the tracks sampled near the entirety of Dancing Queen. So basically had Dancing Queen and just did stuff over the top of it.
Brilliant. Okay, so nobody in 1987 objected to the word fuck in an album title.
No, apparently not. I wonder how
that's
they...
That's bizarre. So that's okay, guys. You can do that. But
don't steal
other people's songs. Mm. I thought you were going to say ABBA objected, as that was the working title for their new album.
What, 1987?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Pretty sure they'd split by that time, hadn't they? But I'm sure those wonderful Swedish songsters would not have chosen such a title.
No. Songsters or swingers?
Well, there were two couples,
wow,
weren't there?
I'm not saying.
I think we're going to get in trouble with that as lawyers now. Courty and Drummond responded by travelling to Sweden, presenting a gold disc marked for sales in excess of zero to a prostitute, and then setting fire to most of the copies of the album in a field. On the ferry home, they threw the remaining copies overboard and gave their only live performance that year as The Jams in exchange for a Toblerone.
I thought I was crazy, but they're absolutely insane, aren't they?
After releasing a second album with a less aggressive approach to sampling, which also garnered them better reviews, Courty and Drummond retired the Jams moniker and cast about for what to do next. The Jams, the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo. They decided to make a number one record. Fair, this intro is going on a bit longer than I expected.
I'm thinking you've queued up the wrong record there.
No, it's absolutely
definitely the right track.
Absolutely the right track. So this, in case you couldn't tell, is a version of the Doctor Who theme that they released as Doctoring the TARDIS under the name The Time Lords.
Now I recognise it.
Tell me more.
Every Christmas since 1987. So this wasn't sampling then?
They were allowed to sample it. I presume they got clearances. But it hit number one.
This was number one. I was worried. I tried not to cough over it then because I thought I might ruin it. But I think I might have improved it. Just try this. Hold on.
We've just sampled.
There you go. I've just sampled that.
That was good. Improvement.
I didn't think this would be a number one track. But can I tell you a slight side story?
Please do.
You won't believe me, so go and Google this. You know the noise at the beginning? The TARDIS going...
Yes.
Would you like to know how they made that noise?
Please do tell us.
So the BBC Sound Effects Orchestra, which isn't called that, but it's a good working name. You can Google that and work out what they're really called. Were given the job of making this amazing noise when the TARDIS and Doctor Who started in 1963.
1963.
And they came up with some probably Class A drugs. And when they finished taking those, they went, I know, why don't we get a door key and a double bass string and slide the door key up and down the double bass. And that's how they came up with they probably did something with some filters, but they didn't really have all the digital stuff that we have nowadays.
Yeah.
So that's how they made the noise.
That's very Brian Wilson, isn't it? Sliding a door key up a double bass.
It's very stupid. And presumably he got home that night and couldn't find the door key.
Or the double bass.
Or the double bass, true. Anyway, we have to do the story, so go for it.
Described as a record so noxious that a top 10 place can be its only destiny, Doctoring the TARDIS sold over a million copies and went to number one. Drummond and Courty soon released a book called The Manual, How to Have a Number One the Easy Way, a guide to making it to number one with no connections, experience, or possibly even instruments, but rather through an act of sheer will.
Magical power.
Absolutely. Now, with enough money to build a recording studio in Courty's basement, the two of them settled on their new name, the KLF. Which is said to stand for either the Copyright Liberation Front or the Kings of Low Frequencies.
KLF, it can't be Copyright Liberation Front. What was the other one?
I think Kings of Low Frequencies.
Yeah, I think I'd heard both those. Both rubbish.
They had re-released a track, Burn the Bastards, from their second and final Jams album, under that name, just prior to the Doctor Who record. So they had started using it a short while before.
Okay.
Now, though, in the year since reforming as the Jams, dance music had replaced hip-hop as the genre in their sights.
Yes, and what do you associate dance music with?
Ecstasy.
MDMA. Yes, exactly.
They planned to release a series of singles, including a new song, What Time Is Love, a song that they would frequently return to. They released What Time Is Love and 3AM Eternal between 1988 and 1989. In October 1989, they appeared at the Helter Skelter Rave in Oxfordshire. They distributed their performance fee into the 4,000-strong crowd, throwing out £1,000 of Scottish pound notes, upon which had been written, Children, we love you.
Oh, that is lovely.
Yeah, it's quite nice of them.
It is, yeah.
Very charitable.
Yeah, shame I wasn't there.
In 1990, they released Chill Out, their first album as the KLF, a continuous piece of music meant to represent the come down after the rave, with a pastoral cover meant to evoke the rural raves of the period. The next, even stranger phase of their career was to come. Throughout their time as the Jams and later the KLF, the two had received odd letters. This may have been due, in part at least, to their connection with Discordianism, adherents of which were prone to send odd letters into publications like Playboy as part of a wider agenda of invoking Eris, Greek goddess of chaos.
Okay, most people detonate bombs or things like that.
I'm glad they didn't.
Well, I'm glad they didn't, but sending a letter, dear Playboy, the world is made out of cheese. That's not really...
To be fair, that's probably quite accurate. It's that sort of thing, a bit of sort of playful, slightly mad.
P.S. Can I have 6 free copies?
One letter Courty and Drummond received in mid-1988 was a legal contract from a person, being, entity, or concept, calling itself Eternity, which required them to produce a work of art representing their journey to the White Room. This, in turn, would give them access to the real White Room.
Sorry, you can't see my face because this is radio, but that's all just... weird rubbish.
Not one to step down from a challenge, they attempted to create an experimental film chronicling their journey to the White Room. The film, which was never released, features them at a rave. They then get into a Ford Galaxy, a vehicle they had previously mocked up as Ford Time Lord for the Doctoring the TARDIS single, resplendent with their speakers and pyramid logo, and drive around various landscapes, eventually reaching a large white building, which they enter. Inside, they don fake moustaches and meet their solicitor, who has the Eternity contract. It's the letter that they receive. Okay. The film was never finished or released.
Oh, no, what a shame.
It cost £250,000 to make.
So they basically burnt £250,000.
Pretty much.
Where did they get all their money from?
Selling records and getting number one records.
In the days when you could make money from music.
Indeed, yeah. Okay. Prior to the current age of...
Prior to Spotify.
iTunes, Spotify, Napster and all the others. What I particularly like about that track is that it would have played in dance clubs with a man shouting Ancients of Moo Moo again and again, and most people probably didn't know what that was about, I'm imagining.
I think a lot of the people who listened to that were so off their face and tits that they probably didn't even notice somebody shouting Ancients of Moo Moo. That was probably the least of their worries. They were more concerned about the pink elephant that was trying to eat them.
Mm. Or it made more sense.
Yeah, my worries. 3AM Eternal.
Yep, so that's 3AM Eternal. You know that one, I presume?
I do know that one. That was a big part of my youth.
My youth. Yeah,
my youth. That was a great tune. But I didn't know. Yeah, so when that came out, everyone did say sort of like, what does that mean, Vengeance of Moo Moo? Yeah. Nobody, I had no idea it was anything to do with...
You know, it's the Justifying Ancients of Moo Moo,
sect
that worship chaos in a trilogy of books that lots of people talk about, but very few people have actually read.
Because it's so badly written that you can't read it.
No, I'd say it's well written, it's just...
But you can't read?
No, it's just dense.
If it's dense,
well,
it's not really well written, is it?
Maybe it just requires some dedication.
But you have dedication.
Do I?
To me.
Oh, that's sweet.
No, it's sweet.
Shame it's not true.
I'm not true.
So yes, that was 3AM Eternal, one of the singles off their 1991 eponymous White Room album. So they did produce the soundtrack album to the film that they never released that cost £250,000, which featured many of their well-known songs, including 3AM Eternal, What Time Is Love, Last Train to Transcendental, and Justified and Ancient. It would also be their last album, with Justified and Ancient being the last original release by the KLF. It featured country legend Tammy Wynette on vocals, with the single being released as Justified and Ancient, Stand by the Jams.
You'd say that the last original single for them to make, that wasn't really original, was it? Because it was all, everything in there still sampled.
Well, no, there was original stuff in there. Yeah. And they did release records after this, but it was mainly, well, as the KLF, but it was mainly remixes or reworked versions of their original stuff.
They basically had one successful album. Is that right? That,
well, no, because they had all those. The two Jams albums. Admittedly, they had to burn most of the first one in a field.
Yeah.
Second one, I think, did successful. Okay.
If you have to burn it in a field and chuck it overboard, that's, and do a live gig for a Toblerone, that's not a...
The first one, I'll submit, was not a success. I think the second one did okay, and then they had their Chill Out album, and then they released The White Room. But where they got most of their success, and indeed their money from, were their singles. So they released a lot of singles, lots of reworked versions of the sort of four or five key songs that they had, really.
Yeah.
And they were the biggest selling singles band in the early 90s. They did very, very well for themselves.
Did they really?
Internationally, they did very well, and a lot of money. They also released this, but as the Jams rather than the KLF in 1991.
Sounds kind of familiar, but I can't. Oh, it's just All Aboard, All Aboard. They all sound a bit similar.
It is dance music.
Wait, that was that. It is.
Oh, wait a minute. Fucked it up.
Yeah, fucked it up, haven't you? You played the wrong track there, haven't you?
Oh, I played the right track, but I was playing the other track underneath it.
You were playing two tracks at once?
I sampled it. Right, this try that again. I mean, you get the idea.
Oh, they're naming all of God's favourite towns, aren't they?
The track's called It's Grim Up North.
Well, that's not true.
Well, I mean, you would know.
I would know. Yeah, it's a place up north. I don't think I have ever heard that before.
No, I think it's quite well regarded, but I don't think it got very much airplay. I mean, it's not very...
That's surprising.
A bit very clubby.
No.
I'd submit.
I think the version that you played before, that you probably now edited out, but you accidentally played it with one of their other tracks...
I thought it was quite good.
Better, yeah, you could do this.
I should probably read their How to Get a Number One Album book, but I said, I would imagine it's probably a bit out of date.
I don't think, who does number one albums anymore?
Yeah, that's true. So they planned it to be a prominent track in their follow-up to The White Room, which they were going to call The Black Room. The sleeves note read, "Through the downpour and the diesel roar, Rockman and King Boy D can feel the regular dull thud. Whether this is an internal echo of a Victorian steam-driven revolution or the turbo kick of a distant northern rave is irrelevant." Thus inspired, the Jams climb back into their truck and work.
Okay, I'm going back to my earlier comment here. Somebody, the person making the most money here was their dealer, wasn't it?
The KLF or the Jams, or whatever they were going to call themselves, intended for the Black Room to be a collaboration and approached Motorhead. Motorhead declined, so Drummond and Courty approached premier grindcore band Extreme Noise Terror.
And he's shouting murder.
It's the song title.
Great song title, Murder. Did people make money from releasing?
Quite a lot of money, and they're still knocking about even now. That's them in the late 80s, shortly prior to their assignation with the KLF.
I think my careers teacher should have told me to do that. Stand on stage, scream murder, hit the drums really badly.
Yep.
And earn a load of money.
Indeed.
Yeah.
The album was never finished.
Oh, gutted.
In 1992, the KLF were nominated for the Brit Award for Best Band. Courty suggested Drummond should cut off his hand and throw it into the audience. As a compromise with reality, they instead planned to dismember a dead sheep on stage and brought a dead sheep from an abattoir for that purpose. This was after it transpired it would probably be easier than slaughtering it live on stage, given the challenges of transporting a live sheep.
And also explain to the Brits people what you plan to do with the sheep on stage.
So not only that, this may have gone down badly with Extreme Noise Terror, who would be appearing at the stage with them, as they were extreme vegetarians.
Always, it's always the vegetarians spoil things for the rest of us, isn't it?
Sorry for the sheep slaughtering carnivores.
Yeah.
In the end, the performance took place with Drummond finishing the act by firing blanks from an antique machine gun into the audience. It was their farewell performance. Loudspeakers announced that the KLF had left the music industry. They also dumped the sheep on the steps of the after party with a note reading, "I died for you." You as in?
E-W-E.
E-W-E.
Oh.
A lady sheep.
We all die for women.
They had had a successful run. They were the most successful singles act in the world in 1991.
Wow. Mm. That's impressive.
But they really meant it when they said they were leaving. They deleted their entire back catalogue.
No!
Really. As they owned their own material, they were able to essentially wipe their music off the map.
No way.
With the lone exception being an American release of The White Room that they'd lost control of.
And of course, all the millions of copies they'd already sold to everybody else.
Absolutely, but you couldn't get hold of them.
Wow.
Yeah, by hide nor hair after that.
Wow.
Apart from, yeah, exchanging already sold copies. Of course, by doing that, they were also completely robbing their own ability to make any money off of their career.
Yeah, or to do a 2017 comeback tour.
Indeed. Oh. File sharing in the internet age has meant that music can be easily... File sharing
in the internet age means that music can be easily shared.
He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghost. Right, good to go.
I can read this, and I'm not even, I can't even see the screen. And
File sharing in the internet age has meant that music can be easily redistributed. Their catalogue allegedly emerged on Apple iTunes about 5 years ago, but it turned out these were put on without their permission by a distributor of bootlegs, and it got re-deleted.
No way. So the Copyright Liberation Front had a go at somebody for breaching copyright.
Well, they are coming from a place that they don't want to earn more money off it, which is, of course, what most copyright disputes come from.
Do you know what? I bet you there'd be a really good legal point there that they can't stop that.
Why?
Because most legal things, there has to be a loss, doesn't there? Contractual loss.
Loss or gain.
Yeah, loss or gain. And they could argue that the defence or whatever could say, well, actually, you don't want any money out of it, so you're not complaining, you know, not releasing it. And you've already said that you don't want the money, so there's no loss to you. This is, for anyone listening, this is another reason why I'm not a qualified lawyer.
Upload the KLF.
Yeah.
Oh, no, actually, maybe don't do that.
No. That's incitement to copyright breach. I think that's another 20 years in prison for you.
Just add it onto the pile.
Yep.
The press that picked up on these acts noted the financial suicide they were committing, with Select magazine stating it was the last grand gesture, the most heroic act of public self-destruction in the history of pop. And it was also Bill Drummond and Jimmy's Quarty's final extravagant howl of self-disgust, defiance and contempt for a music world gone foul and corrupt. So it's been kind of framed as a screw you to the music business.
Yeah, I'm guessing that they don't pop round to Simon Cowell's on Christmas Day and share in his Christmas lunch.
I highly, highly doubt it.
Yeah.
It was the equivalent, Select said, to piling up maybe a million or more £5, dousing them in petrol and woof. They're quite similar to when they burnt all their albums.
So these guys have gone up in my estimation.
In what way?
That was quite ballsy. That's quite impressive. I mean, lots of people would like to do that. We never do.
They're committed.
Yeah, they are committed. They need to be committed. They should be committed. Mental Health Act exists for people like this. No, but they obviously do, don't they? They've got some principles. They've got some ideas.
They follow it through.
They follow it through. Do you reckon they're happy, though? But importantly, are they happy? Are they?
Well, we'd have to ask them, I suppose.
When they take us to court, we can...
We can have a challenge. Ask them, As an aside, their Brit Award was later found buried in a field near Stonehenge.
Right. That is, again, just self-publicity, isn't it? Because... Of course it is. If you were going to bury a Brit Award, of all the fields in all the world to bury it in, and then somebody comes out, it's a Brit Award.
Who does it belong to?
Yeah. Oh, they've helpfully left their name on it.
Although they have deleted their entire back catalogue at this point.
Yeah,
what's the promotion in aid of?
Look, I'm just here to pick holes in your story. Don't look at me for answers. What is it there for? I don't know, because they're going to do a comeback tour in 2018, next year. You wait and see.
In 1993, they emerged as the K Foundation, distributing adverts stating, "Abandon all art now." They announced a shortlist of the 4 worst artists of the year, which was the same shortlist as that year's Tate shortlist. They stated they would give £40,000 to the winner of the Worst Artist of the Year award, an amount twice that of the Turner Prize itself.
That's insane.
They announced the winner as Rachel Whitehead CBE, first female winner of the Turner Prize, and when she refused to turn up to collect her winnings, they nailed them to a board and threatened to set them on fire. They've nailed £40,000 to a board and threatened to set it on fire. The notes had been doused in gasoline by the time Whitehead eventually turned up and rather disgruntledly said she would donate the money to young artists.
Good for her. Hmm. That is a waste of £40,000 to not do that.
Indeed.
But if you think about it, £40,000, what was it, £10 notes?
10 or 5,
so I suspect. So that's 4,000 notes, mm-hmm. right? And each of those can be rolled up and used to snort at least one line of coke.
Mm.
So that's a lot of students that could benefit from that, isn't it?
A lot of young artists.
A lot of young artists.
Later, they made their first and final public exhibition as the Kay Foundation. Entitled Money, a Major Body of Cash, the key piece was Nailed to a Wall, comprised of £1 million in cash nailed to a wooden board, with a reserve price of £500,000. This was exhibited in a field near Heston Services. There were no buyers.
What?
Well, it's probably because they were in a field near Heston Services, but...
There were no buyers, yeah, but generally, if you put £1 million up, but half a reserve price of £500,000, somebody will buy it. I'd buy it.
I don't think they advertised it very well.
No, probably not.
No. Mm. On the 23rd of August 1993, Gorty and Drummond took their £1 million in cash to the island of Jura. At an abandoned boathouse, they slowly and methodically, over 2 hours, burnt the whole £1 million.
Bollocks.
They did.
They burnt £1 million. Oh my God. Oh my God, they burnt £1 million.
They filmed themselves doing it, so there is evidence.
Oh, you idiots. You sure it's not CGI Chikma photography? They burnt £1 million.
They burnt £1 million in cash.
Okay, now my brain is going from the slightly crazy through to the quite funny stage through to the... That's just criminal. That is... Yeah, you're down the route now. It is criminal.
How is it criminal?
You think of all the good that £1 million could do if you gave it to... me, you know, and then you're just burning £1 million, you're destroying £1 million. If you're going to do that, go to Vegas, all the money on black, and, you know, see what happens. That's a better way to deal with £1 million rather than burn it.
Well, if you look at it in the way that they deleted their back catalogue and therefore prevented anyone earning any money off of
it. Did that lose money? Yeah.
So, feasibly, that could have lost goodness knows how many millions of pounds. But also, they're removing the money from circulation entirely. If they would just go to a casino and bet it all on black and put it on, the money then goes back into circulation with the casino and suddenly the casino's pockets are lined with their cash.
Okay, if you burn £1 million, it removes it from circulation. I reckon a really clever economist would point out that actually what you do is you increase the value of all the remaining pounds or something like that.
Something to do with sterling and
I don't know, yeah.
Silver reserve and I don't really understand it, as you could probably tell.
No, you were hiding that really well.
They filmed it and travelled around the country for a year, exhibiting the film, watched the Kay Foundation burn £1 million.
Did they charge £10 per entry ticket?
I don't know. I'd actually suspect, given their disdain for money, probably not. They held question and answers, but were unable to answer the most pertinent question.
Why?
Why? Mm. When asked if the act was a denial of the material world, Drummond said, "No. Some days it's that. It's not really that. We could have done with the money, but we wanted to burn it more." Gorty said they wanted to do something more interesting than giving it away to charity. So there's also a video of them on an Irish chat show where the sometimes extremely irate audience confront them. And on the comments to that video on YouTube, someone has put, "I lost a tenner once. I was fucking gutted." Which really did quite amuse me.
It's not that I don't believe a lot of what you say, but I've just Googled it, and you're right. This is all true. There's all sorts of Kay Foundation burning £1 million. It's just bizarre. Why would you do that? And in 1994, I know what I was doing in 1994, and it wasn't burning £1 million.
Mm. Eventually made a contract not to speak of the matter again, and to postpone the Kay Foundation, the KLF, the Jams, whatever, for 23 years. This was in part to give them a chance to formulate a response to their burning of £1 million. They wrote the contract on a Nissan Bluebird and pushed it off a cliff. The KLF lay dormant for 23 years until August 2017. That's the story anyway. So they did stick to their 23 years of not doing anything.
And is that where the 23 years takes us up to? My maths is...
Yes, 2017.
Wow.
And the number 23 has a lot of importance in Discordianism and other bizarre esoteric things.
Right.
You probably remember there was a film with Jim Carrey a few years ago.
What, called 23?
It was called The Number 23.
Oh, was it?
And it was all about, he started spotting number 23 everywhere and drives him mad. Yeah, it's a whole thing. I mean, Discordianists would admit that it means nothing, but still record where they spot things.
Okay, so I don't know if you found this. I know you do a lot of research, but in 2004, Drummond was asked by the BBC if he regretted it.
Go on.
What do you think he said?
I'd say no, of course he wouldn't.
Of course I regret it. Who wouldn't? My children especially regret it, but I don't regret it all the time. I remember once one of my children came home from school and said, "Somebody told me in the playground you burned 100 quid. Is it true?" And I said, "I wish that was true." Do you know what? Actually, for that reason alone, that's probably quite smart. That'd be great.
Mm.
Just to say to your kids, "No, I didn't burn £100. £1 million.
£1 million.
Be worth it just for that.
Now go and enjoy your free school dinners.
Yes. I can't buy it. No, sorry, you can't have any more shoes.
I'm sure Bill's made lots of money by other means, or at least enough money to support his family. But even so, yeah, I think his family must have been spitting nails at one point or another. Now, although they did lay dormant as the KLF for 23 years, they did come back together in 1997 as 2K, releasing Fuck the Millennium, a reworked version of What Time Is Love, mocking or protesting the Millennium Dome construction. They appeared for a 23-minute performance at the Barbican Arts Centre, directed by Ken Campbell. Fuck the Millennium. Is it Ken Campbell or Ken Russell? Because I've said both.
Oh, well, you're useless. I'll do your research for you.
Yeah, that would be good. Fuck the Millennium was heavily marketed as a comeback, but they disappeared immediately after. The comeback was seen as mocking the very concept of a comeback.
So they made a comeback to mock a comeback.
Mm.
Did they then burn £1 million?
No, but you'll note they only performed for 23 minutes.
Oh, there we go again, number 23.
They're up to it. At 23 minutes past midnight on the morning of Wednesday the 23rd of April 2017.
23 minutes past midnight, yes.
Courtney and Drummond drove into a back street of Liverpool in an ice cream van to begin 3 days of events. Their first new work, a trilogy of dystopian fiction, an end of day story called 2023, a trilogy. The book features three men who draw and burn £1 million in front of the Houses of Parliament. And they conducted 3 days of events, although interestingly didn't play any music.
Not much of an event then, is it really?
No, but then I think they really were done with the whole music thing.
Did they give out ice creams?
They don't think they did, actually. They didn't
the point of having ice
Scottish £10 notes at anyone.
Or ice creams.
So the book features the quote, "Everyone sees it for what it is, the vanities of successful rock stars with not enough money to burn. The three of them tried to save some sort of artistic grace by claiming they were misunderstood and they were going to call a 23-year moratorium on their collective creative activities. In their reckoning, these 23 years would give the hoi polloi, the art establishment and the international jet set enough time to assess the reasons why three ex-rock stars felt whim enough to burn a pile of money so big it could have saved 1 million starving Ethiopian babies from certain death." Which I think is probably as close as we'll get to an explanation as to why they burnt £1 million.
Hmm.
At the same time, posters went up in cities displaying the messaging, 2017, what the fuck is going on?
I miss those, but I like it.
They released messages to volunteers to explain what would happen over their 3 days of events. And I'll just read it out for you. Liverpool, welcome to the Dark Ages. Day one, why did the K Foundation burn £1 million? Day two, 2023, what the fuck is going on? Day three, the rights of mummification, or it's a play on mummification. There will be only 400 tickets available. There are no guest lists, there are no press passes. Every one of the 400 ticket holders will be expected to be volunteers. Warning, the justified ancients of Mumu in any of their various past, present or future guises, will not be performing music. The justified ancients of Mumu will be throwing a graduation ball following the events of Welcome to the Dark Ages. The graduation ball will be for all of the volunteers who have graduated to the Dark Ages. The graduation ball will be at the Invisible Wind Factory. The Invisible Wind Factory is many things. One of these things is a nightclub. The Invisible Wind Factory's door will open at 10 p.m. on Friday the 25th of August. The address of the Invisible Wind Factory is 3 Regent Street, Liverpool. There will be guest DJs, DJ Food and Greg Wilson. There will be a world premiere screening of the 69-minute director's cut version of the film 2023, What the Fuck is Going On. There will be one and only one performance by Badger Cull. Badger Cull will be performing their one and only song. Their one and only song is Toxteth Day of the Dead. Although the graduation ball will be free for all the volunteers who have graduated to the Dark Ages, there will be a limited number of tickets for the general paying public, £10 entrance fee. On the guest list will be Vladimir Putin plus one, the little perch, the 23 sparrows, and Tatiana and Christina, but no one else. The graduation ball will last as long as it lasts, or until the last of the little perch has been kicked out and thrown back into the Mersey. Be there at the birth, and remember, life is the gateway drug to death.
Right. Yeah, life is the precursor to death. I got that bit, the rest of it.
There's lots of repetition.
Did Putin turn up?
I very much doubt it. He was probably too busy riding a horse, bare-chested.
Don't start saying anything bad about Putin. I don't mind annoying the Scientologist and Drummond, but I don't want a KGB after us. Yeah, they're mad, aren't they?
Well, their 3 days of events,
yeah,
if it makes any sense at all, seem to boil down a march through the city towards a pyramid structure. A writer who witnessed it, named Gary Astor, described a large patch of empty ground opposite the invisible wind factory. Empty no longer, though. It contains a large pyramidical structure, 23 foot high, I learned later.
It's invisible.
Which has evidently been prepared for a fire. No, the pyramid's not invisible.
No, but how does he know it's opposite the invisible wind factory?
That's the name of it. Yeah, it's called the invisible wind factory. It's not actually invisible.
Or a wind factory.
No, indeed. Well, I mean, do you have such a thing as a wind factory?
Fair point. Go on.
The pyramid had been evidently prepared for a fire. The two coffins carried all the way from the flory are placed onto the pyramid. The piper plays, into the pyramid, I should say. The piper plays his lament again, familiar to KLF fans from the track America No More. Then Bill and Jimmy don their horns, take up flaming staffs, and put it to the flames. I thought I had a handle on what had just unfolded. It seemed to me that this was Drummond and Courty bidding farewell to the justified ancients of Moo Moo, the KLF, and their myriad offshoots. They unveiled some ambitious plans, including the People's Pyramid, but these remain unfulfilled. And although they did have some pretty decent K2 plant hire hard hats and high-vis jackets made up. On Saturday morning, there was one final situation. Conceptual architect Paul Sullivan presented his design for the People's Pyramid, based on an original drawing by Jimmy Courty. I asked where they planned to build it. The precise location has either not been found or settled on, but somewhere in the vicinity of Toxteth, apparently.
Because that's what Toxteth needs, a pyramid.
A People's Pyramid.
People's Pyramid.
And I think that's as close as we'll ever get to understanding any of it.
Do you know, this is really good because how many podcasts have we done? Three now?
Yeah.
Plus the pilot, okay? So, I am now more confused than I was when we started this about an hour ago. So
well, that's good.
Thank you for reducing my knowledge level. That's an achievement.
I think, relay to me the key events that you've learned today.
So, Drummond was very nearly a steelworker.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering more now, what would have happened if he'd been a steelworker? We would have had some amazing quality steel. Not saying we haven't. And then, right, his mum must have been kicking herself because she spent her hard-earned cash on a career advisor that I bet you she could get her hands on him now. She'd kill him. So he suggests she become a musical instrument.
This is very well remembered.
Musical instrument
You're not
maker.
Even referring to your notes.
No, I'm not. I actually listened to you. He didn't become a musical instrument maker. He became a set maker. Right?
Yep.
In Liverpool, in Everyman Theatre in Liverpool, and then went down to London with... Oh, right, so either Ken Russell or Ken...
I think it's Ken Russell, but I botched it.
So the other one, Ken Campbell, they have a link to Ken Campbell as well, because I asked Siri, and so there is a link there. And then he went out, sniffed some glue and thought, bollocks to this, I'm successful and good at what I do, and walk away from it all. I wish I'd ever been good at being creative, well, good at anything.
Mm.
And then he goes, yeah... I missed Liverpool, and went home.
He's Scottish.
I missed Liverpool. I missed Liverpool. I went home to Liverpool. Okay, went back to Liverpool.
Sorry, Scotland.
And Liverpool. And people called William. And then he started a really weird band where instead of making your own music, you just copy everybody else's. Funnily enough, ABBA didn't like that. Tried to sue him, and then burnt it all in Scotland.
Literally burnt £1 million.
Then deleted all their music so that nobody else could ever make any more copies of it. Told their son that he'd burnt £100. No, he hadn't burnt £100, he'd burnt £1 million. And then did an event in Liverpool where basically he said he's going to build a pyramid in Toxteth and call it the People's Princess.
People's Pyramid.
Yeah. Princess Pyramid. Spring hair.
I think it's something else.
Yeah. That's just really weird.
And it's all a little bit something to do with magic, but it's not really clear how.
Yeah, no, but if he's saying that, it's just willpower. Do you know what this makes me think of, actually? Mm. So the other weirdo bloke on TV.
You might have to narrow down. Could you be a bit more vague?
Noel Edmonds.
Okay. Absolutely cosmic right, ordering.
Yeah, so this is what it is. It does seem a lot like this. Either they're very, very clever and it's all just marketing, etc.
Mm.
Or they just don't give a shit.
I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. So when we spoke
yes,
about...
Yes, first time in my life.
So when we spoke about the different sort of kinds of magic, yes. cosmic ordering, or yes. there was a documentary that went out 10 years ago called The Secret, which was a load of successful people,
I was still in school, so...
Until the restraining order kicked in.
All right.
There was a documentary on that, and it was all about The Secret, which was all about you throw out your intention into the world and it comes answer back to you. So you embody success and therefore you gain success and all that sort of stuff. Very, very popular
that's,
in America.
I think that's the power of confidence.
Yeah, no, that's definitely part of it. Yeah, but cosmic this, ordering this, and The
this
Secret...
There's more than that, okay.
Does say it says there is more to it than just... instantly. So it's more than just the ritual to make you feel confident.
Yeah.
It's something between, as we were talking about when we were talking about magical thinking, the effect... and the psychological, the internal and the external. So when you bring up that example of Noel Edmonds' cosmology, yeah, that's absolutely it. They, Bill Drummond and Jimmy Courte, threw something out into the world when they did all their burning. Mm. I just don't know if we know or they know or anyone will ever know what came back.
I think the biggest thing that has come back, and this is something they should be really amazingly proud of, is this podcast. Because without them being that weird, this podcast would just never have existed.
I think that is.
This is the universe throwing up something back at them. I mean...
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Jimmy.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a blast.
And that was our third episode, all about the KLF. Thank you for listening. Just a little bit about sources for this episode. Our primary source was The KLF, Chaos, Magic, and the Band That Burned £1 Million by John Higgs. Look that up for a wealth of further information about Chaos Magic, Discordianism, the Illuminatus Trilogy, and a host of other things that we touched on this episode, as well as several aspects of the KLF's career that we didn't have time to go into. Please do look that up. Our other sources include John Doran's excellent article on the band from The Quietus in 2008, and several of the videos available online, such as Bill Drummond's videos about recorded music and the interviews that Jimmy and Bill conducted on television shortly after they burned £1 million as the K Foundation, all of which you can find to this day, and really encourage you to look them up. And I'll hope to hear from you soon and see you at our next episode.